Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Vladimir Putin doubling down in his support for his proxies in eastern Ukraine to checkmate gains made by the Ukrainian military. Kathy Young, a contributing editor to Reason magazine and author of Growing Up in Moscow, Memories of a Soviet Girlhood, joins us to analyze the real cause of Putin's exaggerated fear of NATO, which is fear of encirclement by more liberal and modernized societies, which would then exert pressure on Moscow to follow the same path, an argument made in her latest article at Reason.com, Vladimir Putin's Circle of Fear, that we will also discuss. Then we will examine efforts by the former head of the CIA, George Tenet, to sanitize the long-held-up and scathingly critical report compiled by the Senate Intelligence Committee on the CIA's detention and interrogation program. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, joins us to discuss the extent to which the agency is being allowed to vet the report due out next month that is very critical of them, and the apparently hundreds of pages that Tenet and other officials have managed to get redacted, along with slow-walking the declassification process, which has prompted Senator Ron Wyden to complain that this report should have been made public yesterday, and attempts to disrupt and delay it are unacceptable. Then finally, we'll speak with a leading expert on Libya, Dirk Vandeveller, professor of government at Dartmouth College and author of Libya Since Independence, Oil and State Building. We will look into the chaos enveloping the country that was freed from the Gaddafi dictatorship by a NATO bombing campaign, only to descend into factionalism, in which it is difficult to determine where ideology ends and criminality begins, as various militias, ranging from radical Islamists to former generals, battle over oil exports, the parliament building, and the airport in Tripoli. And joining us now is Kathy Young, who's a contributing editor at Reason magazine and the author of Ceasefire, Why Women and Men Must Join Forces to Achieve True Equality, and Growing Up in Moscow, Memories of a Soviet Girlhood. From 2000 to 2006, Kathy Young was a regular op-ed columnist for the Boston Globe, and from 1993 to 1999, she was a weekly columnist for the Detroit News. Her latest article at Reason.com is Vladimir Putin's Circle of Fear. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kathy Young.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And your article, I think, really gets to the heart of the matter here, in particularly when you quote in, I'm talking about Vladimir Putin's Circle of Fear, because there's a number of articles. By the way, it looks like it's gone viral, Kathy, because I read it on the Sydney Morning Herald's
Yes, apparently it has been reprinted in a number of places, which is nice, obviously.
Right, and
it's a pretty hot topic right now.
Sure.
So, you know, it's
Investigative journalist Stephen Pizzo, he was also distributing it. But in your article, you quote a retired Russian general and former arms negotiator, Vladimir Dvorkin, who said the real cause of Kremlin's anxiety about NATO expansion is not fear of invasion, an absurd idea given Russia's nuclear arsenal, but fear of encirclement by more liberal and modernized societies, which would then exert pressure on Russia to follow the same path. And that seems to me to be pretty obvious. I mean, I'm surprised.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that was when you look at starting in the middle of the previous decade, when Putin had a very strong reaction to the so-called color revolutions in the former Soviet republics, especially the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, where you had Yanukovych, who was the pro-Russian politician, trying to steal an election, and people turned out en masse in the in Kiev's main square, the so-called Maidan, which actually just means square in Ukrainian, by the way. They wore orange because those were the campaign colors of Yanukovych's then rival, and that was why it became known as the Orange Revolution. And Putin just was really obviously terrified by that, and also his reaction immediately was to think that this was something that was instigated by the Americans. And that's really very telling, because I think that is really his mentality also, that, you know, why would all those people come out into a square, you know, just because somebody tried to steal an election? I think Putin is really thoroughly cynical, and it really doesn't even cross his mind that people could be sincerely driven and motivated by, you know, civic conscience, really. And I think his first reaction is, well, you know, somebody must be paying them off to do this. And that's really the roots of all of this current crisis really go back to that, when I think, you know, not only was Putin very kind of perturbed by the fact that he saw Ukraine really kind of slipping away from the Russian so-called sphere of influence, but I think he was also very, very perturbed by the idea that something similar could actually happen in Russia. And that was really the beginning of an ongoing and increasingly severe crackdown on independent civic and political activity within Russia. And I think that, again, kind of leads to where we are today, unfortunately.
Well, it's pretty clear that NATO, in spite of all of Russia's exaggerated fears, and there's obviously a good argument to be made that NATO expansion eastward was not particularly well thought out, and it's certainly particularly productive, because at the end of the day, you know, the Russians' secret services taped the entire Polish cabinet recently in a restaurant.
Oh, that's yeah. Right. Yeah.
And the Soviet, I mean, the Polish foreign minister is quoted saying that you know, it's NATO is useless and the Americans are useless, and our relationship with them is somewhat akin to what Monica Lewinsky was involved with.
Did he actually say that?
I can't use the word that he used.
I'm
giving it an analogy there.
It's an interesting situation because, you know, theoretically, if any country is a member of NATO, the rest of the NATO countries are obligated to help defend them against a foreign threat, or, you know, let alone an actual invasion. But this really does raise the very interesting question, you know, if Russia were to move against, let's say, Estonia, even leaving aside Poland, but, you know, let's take the Baltic republics, which are now part of NATO and which were actually part of the Soviet Union before, you know, are the rest of the NATO countries, including the United States, actually prepared to send a military force to help defend against that? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it does inevitably raise the specter of nuclear war, you know, considering that Russia does have a vast nuclear arsenal. And I think we do live in very uncertain times. And, you know, it is rather eerie that this is all happening just as we're coming up on the 100th anniversary of World War I, as I'm sure I'm not the first to point out.
No, and indeed, also, I think the fact that the Europeans have not really come together in any meaningful way to, they've got sanctions against Russia, but nothing that's really going to bite when Russia clearly shot down this plane.
You know. Theoretically, at least, I believe they're working on a new package of sanctions and trying to agree on that. The question is, you know, would any economic sanctions really, at least in the short term, have an effect? And I think it's really difficult to kind of calibrate something that actually would be effective.
Sure.
Of course, you know, I think this is, in the long term, really hurting Russia's interests, including its economic interests. For instance, one of the things that that has happened recently is, as I'm sure you know, Putin has signed this big trade deal, especially having to do with gas, with natural gas exports with China. And this was trumpeted in the Russian media as a big victory, because this obviously reduces Russia's dependence on European markets, so they can, you know, be less worried about sanctions. But at the same time, a number of Russian analysts who are independent of the government have pointed out that actually China is really getting the benefits of that deal, that they're getting the natural gas at a somewhat below market rate. And they're also going to be hugely involved in the explorations. You know, they're basically taking over a large chunk of Russia's markets, really. And that's something that really could come back to bite Russia at some point, especially because China, you know, unlike NATO, you know, China actually does have claims to parts of Russian territory, because there's this long-standing dispute where China believes that there are lands in Siberia that should be Chinese. And, you know, this is something that I think in the long term really could, as I said, could kind of come back to haunt Russia. But in the short term, of course, it does bolster Putin's position. So.
Sure. And the reason I brought up the sanctions, Kathy, was to point out that if the Europeans can't really get tough over the shoot down of an airliner killing a lot of Dutch citizens, among others, they're hardly going to go to war to protect, say, the Baltics, as you pointed out. But in terms of the thesis that you're putting forth in your argument, Vladimir Putin's circle of fear, quoting that former Russian general, it's so obvious to me that that's what it's about. It always has been about the fact that what Putin offers versus what the West offers. Putin offers a gangster regime. He is a capitalist kleptocrat. Why people think he's a socialist and people support him in Europe and the rest of the world is mind-boggling. But look what he's put forth as his kind of guys. Yanukovych, the kleptocrat who raided and depleted the treasury of Ukraine. The goblin, the gangster that he put in charge of Crimea after he snatched that. And the other guy he put in charge was a scam artist who did a Ponzi scheme on selling apartment buildings that didn't exist. This is what, and these guys that he's got in, these proxies in eastern Ukraine, are just, we've seen from their behavior, with desecrating the bodies and this whole crash site it shows you what kind of, and the insane conspiracy theories these guys have come up with to justify what they've done. But at the end of the day, it's pretty clear to me what's happening now in eastern Ukraine is every gain that is made by the Ukrainian military is checkmated by Putin. He's doubling down. He doesn't give a damn what the West thinks, I don't think.
Oh, yeah, no, that's very obvious. And I think you made a really good point that, you know, it is bizarre that some people seem to see him as some sort of, advocate for progressive ideas, because, you know, he really is a, as you said, a capitalist kleptocrat. And it's really ironic to me. I don't know if you saw The Nation, which is kind of the premier left-wing progressive magazine in the United States. Their latest feature has several articles which are very sympathetic to the pro-Russian position in Ukraine. And, you know, I just really find that amazing. And as you said, these so-called separatist groups in Ukraine, I'm not even really sure if it's legitimate to call them separatists, because they are led not by separatist Ukrainians, as you said, but by actual Russians, not just ethnic Russians living in Ukraine, but, you know, Russian citizens, many of them with ties to the intelligence services. And also there's a kind of interesting wrinkle to all this. A number of the people who have been very critical of the new government in Ukraine have been saying that, you know, they're influenced by these far-right groups, some of which may even have kind of neo-Nazi overtones, all of which is very exaggerated. By the way, these groups really don't have a whole lot of influence over the government at all. But the thing that's ironic is that a lot of these rebel groups that Putin is sponsoring, they actually have a pretty heavy involvement of, you know, basically Russian neo-fascists, who are these ultra-nationalists, some of whom really openly use kind of fascist-type symbols. So it's very scary, really, because I think the thing that's also interesting, and again, I'm not sure how well this is going to play out for Putin eventually. I'm not really sure that even Putin can kind of risk an outright all-out invasion of Ukraine. I could be wrong, but, you know, I think that might be going a little too far, because at that point, I think even the European Union is going to finally wake up and, you know, maybe take somewhat harsher measures at least. And, you know, and that's going to be a kind of point of no return, at which I think he does make himself a pariah. On the other hand, if his proxies lose, I think they could actually become a major destabilizing force for Russia, not for Ukraine, because basically he has created all these armed groups of, you know, a lot of the time extreme nationalists, who are not necessarily all that sympathetic to Putin himself, because they regard him as insufficiently nationalistic and, you know, insufficiently kind of hardcore. And he could have some real trouble on his hands. You know, I think these groups, if they are pushed out of Ukraine and if they end up back in Russia, this could become a kind of a very, very incendiary situation. So, you know, I'm not really that convinced that the game Putin is playing is going to, you know, is really all that wise, you know, for considering his, just considering his own interests.
Right, but he still manages on a daily basis to destabilize this new regime in Ukraine.
Oh, he certainly does.
And that's clearly what he's trying to do. And he's so far he's been successful. But by the way, one of the things that I find that I've actually done bad reporting on, is that we always say how Putin is doing 83% in the polls. I think in your article you had him up to 90%. When I talk to
polls, actually do show 90%. Yeah,
yeah, I know. But I talk to people in Russia, and the intelligentsia loathe this guy, and a lot of people, having grown up in the Soviet Union as you did, just used to lies, and they dismiss most of what is being said. So I don't know that it's reliable to say that Putin is...
Well, you know, apparently some of this is polling that has been done not only by Russian polling services, but also by Western ones such as the Pew reports. So I think it's somewhat reliable. It's also kind of hard to tell at this point. You know, people may be kind of back to where they're lying to pollsters because they, you know, the atmosphere in Russia right now is such that people are kind of afraid of the government once again. There was a point when, you know, during the Yeltsin years, I think people certainly felt, you know, free to say whatever they wanted. I think now it's kind of reverting back to some of the old habits, and I think that may be influencing the polls somewhat. On the other hand, I do think that among the masses, you know, there is unfortunately this sort of imperial syndrome where a lot of people felt, and that's also a feeling that I think the Putin propaganda machine has encouraged for people to feel kind of humiliated by the loss of the Soviet Union and its high status in the scene of you know, international relations. And I think to some extent there is this feeling that you know, Putin is kind of bringing Russia back to its former might and gaining respect. I think this could also be just kind of passing phase, really. And a lot of people think, even as inadequate as the sanctions are right now, eventually I think they are going to make themselves felt. And there, it's likely that there will be a rise in unemployment. There will be, you know, some inflation going on. There will be real problems that are caused by the sanctions. And it remains to be seen, really, to what extent Putin's popularity will survive that. I read actually an interesting article the other day on one of the independent Russian websites, and I forget who the author was, but basically he was saying that the social contract that Putin has basically always had with the Russian public is that they're willing to surrender their freedoms, they're willing to kind of let him be this authoritarian, you know, man in charge, and in return, he guarantees them a pretty good standard of living. You know, he guarantees them a kind of secure income, he guarantees them you know, basically, the health insurance and the retired people getting their pensions paid on time, which was a big problem in the Yeltsin years, and so on and so forth. And now if all of that starts to look like it's not so secure, It's really, really a question whether Putin's popularity can survive that. And, I mean, I personally doubt that it can. And it's also, I think, the annexation of Crimea was this big moment where there was this kind of national euphoria, which was cultivated by the media, but I think to some extent it was genuine. I think a lot of people felt that, you know, finally we have this success, you know, in actually getting some of our land back, as opposed to
endless humiliation, right?
But again, I think that is probably going to be a fairly brief moment. Right now, already, people are being essentially told that you know, a lot of the government's pension funds are going to be essentially raided to pay for development in Crimea, because Crimea is going to be a huge financial sinkhole. You know, it's a lot of their...
Right, and it's also landlocked. There's no access to it, which is some of the reason why people think maybe Putin wants to grab a land corridor. But just in the last minute, Cathy Young, does seem that he did turn on the liberals and the intelligentsia, because he woke up one day after he declared himself president again in that election, which people were offended by. Hundreds of thousands of people showed up in the street demonstrating. It seemed that then he privately, basically, seems like he said, well, screw you guys. I gave you a good standard of living, and now you're turning against me. I'm going to turn to the Narod. I'm going to turn to the Christian right, and I'm going to start, you know, beating up on homosexuals and appealing to the worst kind of rural instincts in Russia.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was a tendency that already existed during his, during his first stint as president. And it's certainly become even more hardcore now. And I think that's certainly something we're seeing. And I think it's all kind of interconnected in that this popular revolution in Ukraine really kind of, you know, sparks Putin's own worst fears of, you know, what might happen if these pro-Western intellectuals actually manage to get large numbers of people on their side and, you know, get hundreds of thousands of people into the streets. And I think that is why, to some extent, he really does see this as driven by self-preservation. And I think he also wants to discredit and undermine this new regime in Ukraine, because then he can tell the Russians, yeah, you see, look what happens when you embrace the so-called pro-Western democracy.
Right.
Everything falls into chaos. And I think that is something that he really wants to have out there in the media in Russia, as something for people to, as something to be kind of a warning to anyone who might want to, you know, challenge the regime.
Well, also, the Pussy Riot played right into his hands, desecrating. Being facetious, but desecrating a church. The European Song Contest was won by a transvestite, and the two perky little Russian girls singing patriotic songs came in second.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
So that reinforces this idea that the West is just a bunch of decadent homosexual lovers, and here we are.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that's, you know, it's really actually amazing to what extent the sort of the anti-gay rhetoric has really become a major part of the anti-Western rhetoric. It's really quite fascinating in a morbid way. You know, there's, I mean, they have all these kind of slurs now, like the gay Europeans. You know, that's how they refer to
the gay
EU,
Europeans.
The kind of patriotic bloggers. They've all referred to the EU as, you know, the gay Europeans.
Well, Cathy Young, I thank you very much. I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Cathy Young, who's a contributing editor at Reason Magazine and the author of Ceasefire, Why Women and Men Must Join Forces to Achieve True Equality, and Growing Up in Moscow, Memories of a Soviet Girlhood. From 2000 to 2006, Cathy Young was a regular op-ed columnist for the Boston Globe, and from 1993 to 1999, she was a weekly columnist for the Detroit News. Her latest article at Reason.com is Vladimir Putin's Circle of Fear. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with Colin Powell's Chief of Staff, Colonel Wilkerson, about how George Tenet and other CIA officials are trying to sanitize the record of torture.
I have breathed all the sea. You're our fan prophecy. our destiny we will not hide. When the sun comes up, it will be on your side.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lawrence Wilkerson, who's a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thank you very much for joining us Colonel Wilkerson. And it does seem that the CIA is being allowed to vet this long overdue Senate Intelligence Report, which is supposedly been due out for a long time, but it was supposedly going to come out next month, that is very critical of the agency. And they've apparently allowed George Tenet and Kofa Black and other officials to redact hundreds of pages. And along with the being slow walking the declassification process to the extent that Senator Ron Wyden is complaining that this report should have been public yesterday in attempts to disrupt and delay it are unacceptable. And of course, the report really is all about the CIA's secret detention and interrogation program. So how does this all strike you?
It strikes me as a major cover up. Nothing new, of course, in the history of the CIA, running all the way back to the incredible one with regard to the Bay of Pigs, Mohammad Mossadegh in 53, and I could go on. 59 covert operations in Ronald Reagan's 8 years alone, none of which we really know the outcome of other than Iran-Contra. CIA is famous for these things, but in this particular case, George Tenet and Kofor Black and John Brennan being involved really makes it profoundly so, because they're trying to cover their butts. These people actually participated in what I think were, and others have said were, Glenn Carl, for example, in his book The Interrogator, which of course too was redacted, war crimes, domestically and internationally. Domestically because they violated what we had signed up to with the International Convention Against Torture and Abuse, and internationally because of the ICAT. So I'd be covering my fanny as fast as I could, too, if I were John Brennan and Kofor Black and George Tenet and all the other people who, unlike some stalwarts and courageous people at CIA, refused to participate, did in fact participate and broke the law, domestic and international.
So how is the Obama administration enabling this? My understanding is it's because of a personal relationship that exists between Brennan, who obviously worked in the White House for some time and I think got fairly close to President Obama, and one of Obama's aides, I think, is it O'Donohue or somebody? I can't remember.
McDonough, right.
So what's is this like an old boys network trying to cover things up?
I do think that's part of it, but you also have to go back to the incompetence that George Tenet largely introduced into the CIA, and I'm not trying to make excuses for this agency. You'll find me most often railing at it in seminar or in public. I think it's time we completely reviewed whether we even need the CIA or not, particularly its clandestine operations portion. But Tenet began the practice of putting analysts, that is, people who knew absolutely nothing about operations, John Brennan being a case in point, out into places that were critical, like station chiefs. And this is the head of CIA operations in a country,
right,
located normally in the embassy.
Right. He went to Saudi Arabia, didn't he?
Yeah, he put analysts out there, and what we're paying for right now is the bill for that. In Berlin, where we've seen these recent examples of utter incompetence, people spying on people they didn't even need to be spying on, trying to recruit incompetence or low-level people into the operation and getting revealed, getting caught in Germany, for example. This is what Tenet started. So some of this has snowballed, and most of the people that are going to be in these reports are the kind of people whose incompetence was put up against this very operational issue of whether we torture or not, rendition, secret prisons, and so forth. So you've got a combination of incompetence on the one hand and breaking the law on the other hand. There's a lot that the CIA as an agency, as a part of the federal bureaucracy, doesn't want revealed. That's largely, as I said, incompetence. And then there's the part that they don't reveal, which is something that might put some of them in jail eventually.
And, of course, the other example of incompetence was the Russian station. My friend Bob Baer was just appalled at the lack of tradecraft involved in the people that the Russians easily caught with stupid wigs.
And Bob Baer is a man who should know.
So, of course, George Tenet, not only did he come out of the analytical side, he really came out of the public relations side. He was a liaison to the Senate Intelligence Committee, and he sort of butted everybody up, I think, and that's how he got the job. And you dealt with him, you and Colin Powell dealt with him in the most profound way before Colin Powell's famous speech to the United Nations the Security Council on justifying going to war against Iraq. You and Colin Powell spent many hours in the conference room off George Tenet's office being fed the intelligence, the best intelligence we had on what Iraq was up to, and most of it was bogus, or at least a lot of it was.
Absolutely correct. And I have come to the conclusion, a very solid conclusion in my view, and it's going to be in my book, that on one or two, possibly even three major occasions, major items of intelligence, George Tenet lied. There's no other conclusion I can come to. George Tenet was working as much for the vice president's office, and the two analysts he put in front of me, particularly Robert Walpole, were answering to the vice president as much as they were answering to anyone in the intelligence community. And they wove this fabric that caught the secretary in ways that I still feel culpable for. For example, when I was handed the first sheet that the secretary was supposed to brief off of, a 48-page manuscript that was written by John Hanna and Scooter Libby in the vice president's office and was written more like a lawyer's brief than anything else, we wasted the first day of only 5 days to prepare Powell for that presentation at Langley. We wasted it going through this transcript, and I finally flung it across the room, literally, and I said to Mr. Tenet, look, we can't do this. We can't waste time. We're only through one page, and we've got 47 more to go. And he snookered me at that moment. He snookered me completely. Looking back on it, I know he did. He said, all right, let's turn to the October 2002 National Intelligence Estimate, which, of course, he was responsible for as the DCI. Well, as I look back on it now and as I've done research and my students have done research, that intelligence estimate used by the president, used by the vice president, looked at by the Congress, was as flawed, if not more so, than that 48-page script. And I say if not more so because it actually, unlike the script, was in fact sourced. That means it was actually identifying the intelligence sources from which it had come, whether it was CIA, DIA, materials intelligence from satellites or whatever. It actually identified it. And all of that went into Powell's presentation, and most of that was at best circumstantial, and as I said before, in my view now, having looked back, having done the research necessary to tell, fabricated. And in at least two, possibly three occasions, that fabrication was rendered to the Secretary of State by the Director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet. He was lying, in other words.
Well, you know, Colonel Wilkerson, I spoke with Tyler Drumheller a while back, and he was a CIA's guy in charge of Europe. And before you and Powell did those days of going over the intelligence, before Secretary of State Powell made his presentation to the UN, which really did seal the deal for the Bush administration to go to war in Iraq, A lot of that intelligence that Colin Powell presented was sourced by this agent called Curveball that the BND, the Germans, had. And he, Tyler, was told by the Germans that this guy was completely unreliable, that he was a drunk and a dissembler, and that he was connected to Ahmed Chalabi, and that you shouldn't believe a word he said. And Drumheller told me that he told Tenet that before he met with you guys, and said, this guy is worthless. You know, and all Tenet did was groan. But then he went ahead and presented this bogus intelligence to you.
In an email to me, Tyler more or less confirmed the same thing. And in another email from another source, I learned that John McLaughlin had talked to Tyler on the phone also, the deputy DCI. I think by that time, Tenet and John were so deeply into this intelligence package that they knew was flawed, that they knew had major problems. They were so deeply into it that they had a choice. They had a choice to resign because they knew that was what was called for if they questioned the president and more so the vice president on those items, or to go along with it. And they chose to go along with it. They chose to go ahead and proceed with the lies, with the fabrications, with the cherry-picked intelligence, rather than standing up and essentially being willing to be fired or resign. And that's the long and the short of it.
But do you think the fact that George Tenet carried water for the Bush White House, and particularly for the main protagonist in the Bush White House, Vice President Cheney, do you think it goes back to 9/11 when George W. Bush came out to Langley shortly after 9/11 and put his arm around Tenet and basically said, you know, let's let bygones be bygones. We're not going to look back. We're going to look forward. I mean, is that what happened, do you think? Because in the real world, if you're head of intelligence and the United States is struck in the worst possible way since Pearl Harbor, you should be fired. That's how the real world operates.
I think you're right, and I think you've just uncovered something that I try to teach in my seminars about character and personality, and you've discovered something where weakness comes together with strength, comes together with weakness, comes together with strength, and creates a hurricane, a real problem. And what I mean by that in this particular instance is George Bush's hail fellow well met, arm around the shoulder, I'm going to give you a nickname and we're going to be buddy-buddy and close, was a talent that George Bush had that I even noticed in the meeting I had with him in the Oval Office. I think that was a very powerful political element for George Bush's character. But you put that together with the fact that he did that. He came across that way with the last person in the federal bureaucracy that you want to have that kind of relationship, the director of your national intelligence organization. That strength meeting weakness and producing a failure, and in this case it produced a failure. You don't want, if you're the president, if you're the ultimate decision maker, to get that close to your head of intelligence. You do that, and your head of intelligence is going to use that closeness and play with that closeness and magnify that closeness in order to increase his power with you. And that catches Tenet in an environment where he's got to feed the ego of the president. He's got to go along with what the president wants to do, which is ultimately what Dick Cheney wants to do. And you wind up with a relationship that is insidious and dangerous. There's a reason why Bill Clinton, for example, never hardly even let his CIA director in the Oval Office. His CIA director, Jim Woolsey, quit because he never could get access with the president. That's going a little bit too far. The proper balance that I saw a president effect was H.W. Bush, who kept his CIA director exactly where he should be, at arm's length, and only called upon him when he needed to and never put his arm around him and said, hey, buddy, you're my buddy. You just do not want to do that with your intelligence director. You are inviting problems. And fast forward, I think that's kind of the way President Obama developed a relationship with John Brennan when he was head of counterterrorism in the White House. And I think that's rebounding to the president's discredit and injury now because he's got a director of the CIA with whom he became too close.
Well, just in closing, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, do you think that this voluminous report by the Senate Intelligence Committee that's been held up for years on the CIA's detention and interrogation program. When it hits the light of day, it's been slow-walked clearly by the declassification process, and now we learn that George Tenet and others, Porter Goss and General Hayden, have been able to look at it in advance and redact stuff that they don't like. Will it be any good by the time it comes out? I mean, what are we going to get if we ever get it?
Ultimately, we'll have to wait and see, but my considered estimate is that it won't be that valuable because they will have taken their very fine-tuned skills at redacting and changing and altering, and we won't know one page from the next precisely what we're reading. If people want to read something that gives them microcosmic but nonetheless revelatory insight into what went on, read Glenn Carl's book, The Interrogator. I mean, Glenn was 20-plus years in the CIA, and he was at one of the secret prisons and called upon to do some of the interrogation, and to Glenn's credit, didn't do it the way they wanted him to. But that book, redacted as it is, because it went through the process too, is as revealing of what went on as anything I've seen. And if this document is so heavily redacted we can't tell anything from it one way or the other, Glenn's book is evidence enough that there were crimes committed.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who's a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the chaos in Libya. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dirk van der Wallen, who is a professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College. He's the author of A History of Modern Libya and Libya Since Independence, Oil and State Building. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dirk van der Wallen.
My pleasure.
And in terms of what's happening in Libya, clearly there's been chaos there since Gaddafi was killed and his regime was toppled. And, of course, it became a political football, Benghazi, largely a manufactured scandal. In fact, the manufactured scandal, I think, has disguised the real scandal, hasn't it, that there's basically no state?
Well, to some extent, that's absolutely right. I mean, we focused so much on Benghazi that we haven't really seen, I think, a larger picture around it. And that is exactly as you described it, that we have what started off as a reasonable experiment, I would describe it, right after the revolution that ended in fall 2011. And what we've seen ever since is really a very gradual disintegration of whatever kind of weak state there was to begin with in Libya. And that has really picked up, the pace has picked up, I would say, over the last few months. And, of course, the most clear example, the clearest example of that really has been the shelling of the airport over the last couple of weeks by different militias in Tripoli.
And the evacuation of the U.S. embassy. And now it seems that Benghazi is erupting. The Islamists have more traction there, I take it, and that for a while back there, they took an oil terminal. and tried to sell some oil on the open market. The ship was intercepted. In terms of oil revenues, are there any coming in, and into whose coffers are they going?
The oil situation has been, as you said, very precariously, and what has happened is that actually an agreement was reached with some of the people in the eastern part of the country, which, as you correctly described, most of the Islamic, particularly the radical Islamic activities have taken place. There was an agreement to bring take the militias out of some of the oil installations, and that has happened. So oil production actually went back up to roughly about 500,000 to 600,000 barrels, which was roughly one-third of what Libya used to produce before the revolution started. But ever since then, of course, that whole problem with the oil is really indicative of a much larger problem that you also pinpointed, and that is that there is a federalist movement in the eastern part of the country that needs, that wants, a greater independence from Tripoli. And that, of course, will be, I think, a political hot potato for years and years to come in Libya.
So there's also been a number of Egyptian soldiers killed on the border there. And clearly, General Sisi has no truck with the Islamists. So what do you think Egypt is going to do in terms of retaliating against, presumably it was Islamist militia from Libya that killed the Egyptian soldiers?
I think probably very little. I think General Sisi, first of all, is quite preoccupied with events at home. And I think the last thing he would want to do is to get involved in what is a very chaotic situation right now in eastern Libya. So my hunch is that this will be resolved somehow. There probably will be some small retaliatory actions by Egypt, although even that, I think, would be very problematic. What I think Egypt in general is more interested in is creating a kind of a buffer zone along the Libyan border, and undoubtedly Egypt will want to pour quite a bit of manpower and resources into establishing that kind of a buffer between the two countries. But again, this is a very porous border. It's very difficult to do. But on the other hand, as I mentioned, the situation in Cairo is such that even though there is an enormous amount of worry about that border, there is relatively little actually that the Egyptians can do at this particular point in time beyond trying to beef up their presence and making the passage between Libya and Egypt more difficult.
So let's talk about the general who I think is fairly favored by the West, who seems to be the best hope, if you will, against the Islamists for, loosely speaking, for Western interests. What kind of support does he have in terms of, I mean, obviously everybody's alluded the enormous military stocks that Gaddafi bought over the decades, so there's plenty of weaponry, but what about organization in terms of who's got the most effective militia?
You're referring to Khalifa Haftar, who was initially, years ago, the commander of the Libyan army when Libya was engaged in a conflict with Chad. Haftar really discredited himself both in that conflict and afterwards, and is seen as a pretty unreliable figure, but has risen, I think, in Libya, particularly because of the chaos you described earlier on, and in part because he does represent to some extent what is common among Libyans, and that is an unease, indeed an intense dislike of some of the more radical Islamists. And Haftar has essentially thrown himself up as a bulwark against these Islamists, and for that reason has been able to claim some allegiance, has incorporated some elements of the former Libyan army, or at least some of the brigades of the former Libyan army. But my hunch is that, in a sense, there is very little loyalty to Haftar himself, although there may be, as I mentioned, sympathy to his cause. I don't think Haftar really represents in any way the future of where this conflict will go. Indeed, my hunch is that if the general situation in the country would die down somehow, that there would be some talks between all sides, and that Haftar himself would very rapidly lose out and again kind of go back to the obscurity where he was before he could exploit the current situation in Libya.
So is this a situation where the majority of the Libyan people just want to get on with their lives? They're happy to see Gaddafi go, but they don't want the Islamists. They don't want a general. So there's really, is there anybody or any, you know, that's likely to satisfy that vast middle of the country, from what I understand? I mean, there was some euphoria, was there not, at getting rid of Gaddafi, but that has probably soured by now.
Very much so. There was indeed quite a bit of euphoria, and indeed I think there was the expectation, including by myself, that a certain type of optimism that the country would be able to rebuild itself. But I think that has largely dissipated over the last 2 years or so, as it became clear that a lot of the politicians that were elected were really out for themselves, for groups that they represented, and that in a sense what was missing in Libya was truly a kind of a national identity, or at least a national political system that could really guide the country. And so what we're seeing is really a kind of a political emptiness in Libya that everybody is now trying to solve. But the main problem, of course, remains that the central government, those that represent the state in Libya, still do not in any way control the means of coercion. That is, they're not in charge of the militias. These militias, more or less at random, do whatever they want, and the government remains dependent on them. That fundamentally has to change. One way of changing it would indeed be, as some people have suggested, to bring in an international force. Not acceptable yet to the Libyans, although they have moved a little bit closer to that over the last few weeks. But my hunch is that because of all I've just described, that we will continue to see a kind of a lingering chaos in Libya, certainly for the foreseeable future, if not for perhaps several years into the future.
But Dirk van der Velde, just in terms of the trying to get a handle on who the militias are, particularly Islamist ones, it's hard to know where ideology and religion end and criminality begin. I mean, there was a political assassination of the prominent human rights lawyer and activist Salwa Bogassis, who was killed in her Benghazi home. There was also a huge amount of cash was looted from the central bank. Is there a discernible ideology here amongst the Islamists, or where does criminality end and ideology begin?
Well, I think you've really put your finger on what has really been a major development since the end of the Civil War, and that is that, as I said, initially everybody started off with these kind of feelings that Libya would be able to kind of build itself up, that these militias would be able to play a legitimate role in the reconstruction of Libya. But very soon after that, very soon after the revolution ended, indeed it became very unclear sometimes what was a genuine militia and was what was pure banditry, and certainly we've seen a number of incidents, some of which you described, where it's very clear that because of the lack of control, the continuing chaos, that certain criminal elements have really very clearly taken advantage of it, certainly even in Tripoli, but particularly in Benghazi. Some of the quarters inside the cities are almost being run in a mafia style by some of the local bosses. But I think you have to distinguish quite clearly between Islamist militias, and remember that Libya is an Islamist country, has a very strong tradition of a kind of a more reflective, a Sufi-inspired Islam, as it's called. And then you have to contrast that to a number of more radical groups, radical Islamists, that have really emerged since the revolution. Libyans would like to see, as they've expressed repeatedly, including in the elections leading up to the Constitutional Assembly, would like to see Islam very much as part of their constitution, as part of the way that the country is governed. But they certainly do not want the kind of radical solution that groups like Ansar al-Sharia and some of the other more radical ones are proposing. And it is particularly these more radical ones that are the problem. And it is not the mainstream Islamists which have given all kinds of indications that they are willing within the political framework that so far has developed.
Well, one of the theories about international relations that's particularly prevalent on the political left is that the oil companies run the world, and most of geopolitics are about resources. And many argued, including the former chairman of the Fed, that we went into Iraq for the oil. Well, guess what? We didn't. We haven't got much oil. We've got nothing but a headache.
Right.
And it seems to me in Libya, I'm wondering about the oil. I mean, if that was the prize, it doesn't seem to have worked out well for anybody. My understanding is that we all know how much Putin has used the UN resolution over Libya. He's basically been arguing that that was the beginning of his split with the U.S. and NATO,
yes.
that he felt that they took advantage of Russia's vote. Mm-hmm. And they've been quite bitter about it. But my analysis is somewhat different. I think that if NATO hadn't gone in to rescue the citizens of Benghazi, who would have been slaughtered by Gaddafi, Gaddafi would have won, and he would have basically become an international pariah. And nobody in the West could have done business with him, and but that wouldn't have stopped the Russians and the Chinese. So would you agree with that theory?
Well, there's different ways, I think, of explaining what happened here. And as a matter of fact, depending on the scenario that you believe in, either case, the United States would have suffered at least the oil industry. Personally, I don't think the oil factor was that important in Libya. Remember that the United States gets no oil from Libya. Most of the interested parties, I mean, we do have some companies, and certainly to some extent, they've been there for a long time. Remember that American companies helped create the Libyan oil industries, but they've and some of them remain, but they are not crucial to the Libyan oil industry. And as a matter of fact, the Libyan oil industry is considered by most, and particularly by American companies, as a rather troublesome one, and not always a highly profitable one the way it is in other countries. So I don't think the oil sector itself, the oil concerns, played a major role in our stance. Now, for the Europeans, of course, it's very, very different. Remember that Italy, one-third of all oil from Libya traditionally went to Italy. So the Europeans had a much larger stake in the oil industry, and undoubtedly, and particularly if we think back to some of the shenanigans that went on with Great Britain surrounding the oil industry and its presence in Libya, I would argue that your argument, that your scenario perhaps applies more to the Europeans and their interest in the Libyans, but not to the United States.
So at the end of the day, just to wrap up here, what's your sense then? Will this chaos continue? Is there anything on the horizon that would suggest some kind of governance will eventually arrive?
I think it looks problematic at this point. There is one very tiny silver cloud or silver lining to one cloud, and that is the election of the new Chamber of Representatives that hopefully will have some impact and will probably be seen by the Libyan population as more responsible than the GNC, its predecessor, was. But beyond that, I think we have to look at this very realistically. You have an enormous amount of chaos. You have no national figures at this point that can really bring any sense of unity to the country. There is no great interest for any of these militias or different other groups to really compromise because they're getting exactly what they want now. And again, the patronage system that already marked the Gaddafi period has come back. And indeed, the government, the successive governments that we've seen in Libya have themselves used patronage, handing out money to keep the political situation quiet. The only silver lining that would be there, I think, at this point really looks like some kind of international intervention, and that is not likely to happen. The national dialogue among Libyans themselves has not really gone very far. So I'm afraid it is not a very optimistic situation, and why I keep arguing that we will probably continue to see chaos, lingering chaos in Libya for quite a while to come.
Well, Dirk van der Velde, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Dirk van der Velde, who is a professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College. He is the author of A History of Modern Libya and Libya Since Independence, Oil and State Building. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.